Interview with John Fetters, August 9th, 2006, in Washington, D.C., by Kenneth Zur.
Well, thanks very much for agreeing to talk with me today. Well, I want to start with a little bit of background and talk about a little bit of your education and training and how you came to the SEC and were interested in taking a position like that.
Okay, where do you want me to start?
Education.
I was raised in Kentucky. I went to Marquette University in Milwaukee, and then I came to law school here in Washington, D.C. at the Catholic University of America. I was fortunate to be able to get a job with the Cadwalader, Wickersham & Taft firm on Wall Street when I left law school, and I stayed there for 5 or 6 years, and I was given a business opportunity to become executive vice president of a New York Stock Exchange company then called Gulf Life Holding Company, which was an insurance and financial services concern. I stayed there only a couple years because they were going to do a transaction which I contemplated was going to remove them from the marketplace. They would be consumed by another company. And I had an opportunity to come to Arnold and Porter here in New York, or here in Washington. And I stayed here for 8.5 years. And when President Reagan was elected, I was approached about a couple different positions in the time after the election through January. I interviewed for a couple of them. And I was very fortunate to get a very, very large client. I abandoned that effort and stayed at Arnold and Porter. And then when Stanley Sporkin resigned as director of the Division of Enforcement, I got several telephone calls that same afternoon, including one from the White House and one from, I believe, Senator D'Amato's office, and suggesting that maybe this is something I would be interested in. I was flattered, but certainly interested. The process didn't last very long. I was interviewed one Friday afternoon by a chap by the name of Irv Schneiderman, who was a partner in a major Wall Street law firm and who was doing some preliminary interviews for John Shadd. I had a bowl of soup with him on a Friday afternoon, and when I arrived home that night, there was a telephone call asking me if I'd have breakfast with John Shadd the next morning. We met in Georgetown. We had breakfast at a little Greasy Spoon, and we went to a park nearby and sat down, and he had an airplane to catch. And fortunate for me, he kept saying, well, I'll catch the next shuttle, and then I'll catch the next shuttle. And we sat in the park from what must have been 8:30 or 9 o'clock. Well, by the time we had breakfast was kind of 8:30, 9 o'clock, and we were finished in half hour, 45 minutes, and then we sat in the park till well into the afternoon, maybe as late as 4 o'clock, and talked about his ideas and who I was and things like that. There seemed to be some homogenization between the personalities. I liked him. I hoped he liked me. And the meeting kind of ended without any note of expectation from him that I would be a finalist or whatever. I was then called later the next week and told that I was a finalist and that I would have to interview the other commissioners. And I went to the commission and I interviewed several of them. I'm not sure it was all. Commissioner Loomis, I remember. I remember a couple others, but his was the most significant. We spent a good bit of time together, Commissioner Loomis and I. And then sometime later, I was called and said that the job was offered to me, and I accepted without hesitation. And in a matter of 2 weeks, rearranged my life to leave Arnold and Porter and to go to the SEC.
Tell me a little bit about that long conversation in the park. You know, it's hard to imagine not having gotten the idea that you might be seeing this guy again.
Well, I certainly felt good about it, particularly when he said, well, I'll catch the next shuttle. When he said that more than one time I assumed that I wasn't fish bait, that something good was going on. That meeting was very nice. He told me a lot about himself and about his different ideals in life, how he had thought that he would make, had divided his life into three compartments: learning, earning, and giving. And that he was now in his giving part of his life, that he had done his learning and his earning. And so John Chedd told me a lot about himself, a great deal, and about his family and his adopted children and his goals at the SEC. And that's the first time that insider trading arose during that conversation. It was part of the afternoon. It by no means was the dominant part of the conversation. The dominant part of the conversation was management. He questioned me a lot about my days at Golf Life Holding Company, where while I was a lawyer, because that was my profession, I was an executive vice president at the company and did not have legal responsibilities. And I think that attracted John Chedd. And then as the afternoon wore on, I do remember we talked a lot about the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act and the accounting provisions and things of that nature, things of which I had experience. Obviously, I had experience by being at the Arnold and Porter firm and being involved in those cases. I'd written some articles in that area and things of that nature. So, obviously, if he would go to a topic that I felt I had something to say, I would try to romance that topic and continue it on. But I do remember when he said at some point that he wanted to really do a lot of exploring of the insider trading area, either right before that interview or shortly after. In my recollection, it probably came after Fortune magazine ran an article, I think, called The Unwinnable War, about insider trading. It's a topic that's interesting because everyone understands lying, cheating, and stealing. And while Enron and WorldCom and all those cases have received a lot of publicity, most people can tell you is that there was wrongdoing and accounting and mischief of that kind that constituted illegalities. Whereas on an illegal insider trading case, most people can explain to you what went on. And so it was pretty fundamental, pretty easy. That was attractive to me. And so we talked some about insider trading, and it was very clear to me that that was going to be a part of his program. He told me about a lot of other things that he had hoped to do at the commission and the Division of Corporation Finance. He spent a lot of time talking about that. And I had started not as an enforcement lawyer. That became kind of the practice that I had at Arnold and Porter in the latter years I was there. But when I started at the Cadwalder firm, I was really a green goods lawyer. So I was a deal lawyer. I did registration statements, public offerings, mergers, acquisitions. And that might have been attractive to John, that I had done more than one thing in my career to that point. I liked him. I liked the guy's cut. I liked the way he was casual and relaxed and sitting in a park on a park bench. And while I was at least in a sport coat and a tie at the breakfast during the period of the day, I think we both broke down pretty quickly. I don't recall if he was in a tie at all. I know I was, and I know that it wasn't very long that I was comfortable in taking my coat off, then my tie off, and then opening the shirt, because it was a late May, early June. I think it was late May, and it was hot. I remember that.
1981.
1981, right.
Okay. Did you get a sense of what was motivating John Chedd? He came out of the industry.
Right.
So he had some experience that was perhaps different in some ways than, you know, the staffers, the folks who did.
Yeah. What motivated him was goodness. He was an extraordinarily good person, a really good human being. In my years of working for him, I never saw anything about him I didn't like. He was funny. We went to the racetrack together with other division directors on one occasion, and it was an evening of great fun and merrymaking and joy. So I think his goodness was his overriding motivation. He was also into his serving period of his life, and that meant something to him, a third to earn, a third or a third to learn, a third to earn, and then this third of giving. I think he had some definite ideas about the administration of the SEC, the administration of justice. He was very loyal to the president, President Reagan. He liked, I think he liked politics, and it was something he had never been involved in before. And he was hurt by politics at some time because there were some congressional investigations of his conduct as to how he had put his securities in trust at some time. And I think that hurt John personally because he was not a guy who would ever do anything wrong or intentionally worry about. He was too wealthy to worry about doing something like that. But there were mechanics with regard to how it was done. I think he engaged Joe Califano to assist him in handling that. And there was pain associated. I can remember the pain associated with that for him.
This was during his period
as chairman. Yes. I would say in the early year, whether it was 81 or early 82, I don't know. But it came on shortly after I went there.
And that came to nothing in the end, I guess.
I don't believe it came to anything.
You were caught up in one of those, too.
Well, I was caught up in a lot of different things. People thought I was soft on law enforcement. I'm never hesitant to say what I think, and sometimes that can bite you in the butt. I had issued a number of memoranda that I didn't hesitate to circulate to the entire staff that ended up in the hands of Congress. One of them, I remember, I issued an orange book with regard to priorities, and I had put as the last page actions under Rule 2E of the Rules of Practice of the Commission, as it was then Rule 2E, and that that was potential sanctions against lawyers and accountants, and I got called to a congressional hearing. I testified a lot during my tenure there. But for me, it never was controversial or adversarial because I so much enjoy that sort of thing. I like people to attack. I think it's my sports mentality that, I never played in a game where the other team scored zero or where I scored zero, so it's give and take. And while I remember Congressman Dingell went after me, Congressman Worth, and then there were some questions with regard to my role in an investigation of a company called Southland Corporation, 7-Eleven, and there were congressional hearings on that. And at the beginning, I was not permitted to testify because of the attorney-client privilege. And then I became the subject of a grand jury and then testified in trials, and nothing ever came of it for me. I was confident about my conduct. But whereas a lot of people would say to me, oh, isn't it awful? You've got to go testify about this or that, and you're embarrassed or whatever. It never struck me that way. From a personal point of view, because I like that part of life. I like to be tested. As I said, I've never played in a basketball game where I kept the other team scoreless, and I don't mind being elbowed in the gut or somebody scoring over the top of me, because it's only going to motivate me at the other end. So I enjoyed that.
You understood how adversarial politics can be.
Yeah, and I'd lived in Washington, D.C. I think some mistakes were made. Some serious mistakes were made by the Office of Legislative Affairs when John Shedd became chairman and when I became director. As far as how the courtship took place, I was not taken to the Hill and introduced to people, what I would call the vetting process. And my own experience is that John was not, what he told me about what happened. Of course, he was chairman by the time I was interviewed. But what he told me about his vetting process, I'm of the view, without knowing all the facts, that maybe he wasn't vetted adequately. I wasn't vetted at all. And that proved to be an enormous mistake by the Office of Legislative Affairs. But it was okay, because it probably heightened the controversy. They didn't know me, and therefore it was easier to dislike me. And that was fun.
And let's see, these are Democrats?
Well, they were always Democrats. I mean, Senator D'Amato in the Southland thing held a special hearing as a Republican, and it was clearly to give me a forum to speak. So sure, there's politics, but I had been in, remember, I went to law school here. I learned the politics, and then certainly 8.5 years at Arnold and Porter, I had seen the way the town operated politically. Yeah. While I could never see myself as a candidate for public office, I'm not of that. I'm not charming. I would think that I'd learned enough to know that you don't take a job like I was being offered and accept it without expecting to be wounded over the period of time. And then, of course, I resigned in February of 05 over difficulties in my marriage that received a lot of publicity. That was painful for my former wife, I'm sure. I'm sure it was painful for the children who were old enough to understand it. It was painful for my parents and painful for a lot of close friends. But when you look back upon it, when you look about the fact that I made some mistakes in the marriage, what happened as far as my conduct, as far as what my former wife did and what happened in the publicity. And you've got to understand that these things are going to happen, and you go on. And, you know, most of the things that have occurred in my life that have been adversarial, controversial, are of a painful nature, have always redounded to my benefit. A block shot as a young boy, or the difficulties of congressional testimony early on at the SEC, or the difficulties that I went through in resigning and the enormous publicity, because there not only was local publicity, there was a movie, there was a book, there was magazine articles and things like that. In the long run, that all redounded to my benefit, to who I am today at 64.
Well, in the long run, you also had a chance to shape the SEC at one of the most plastic moments for the commission.
Yeah.
And I want to talk about some of those things, certainly about this huge, really, it was a sea change in how the commission looked at and treated insider trading. And I want to talk about some of the early cases that must have been either already in or getting ready to come in when you took office. That would have been, was the St. Joe Minerals case?
Well, I don't remember when St. Joe was filed. Let me put it in perspective how it all came about.
Okay.
I believe Santa Fe had been filed, which was a offshore case, as I would refer to it, and I'll explain that later. And then St. Joe either came a couple days before I got to the commission or a couple days after. I certainly was not responsible for nurturing either of the cases in the investigative stages. That was Stanley Sporkin, and in New York there was a terrific attorney by the name of Bob Blackburn, who was in charge of maybe both of them, but no, I think probably just St. Joe. But here's what happened with regard to insider trading. When I went to the commission, I had the benefit of a lot of individuals who might have had my job, who certainly as securities lawyers were premier lawyers. And rather than exhibiting any jealousy, they exhibited teamsmanship. And consequently, I was the beneficiary of an awful lot of good ideas and scholarship that played well. Now, here's what happened. As far as insider trading, the aggregation of all the ideas was threefold. Three things were happening in the marketplace that had never happened before that permitted this proliferation of insider trading as we saw it. Number one, there was access by traders to offshore accounts in countries that, because of their secrecy laws, were likely to prevent a government regulator like the SEC from identifying who the particular trader was. So step number one is there was some secrecy. You might be able to hide your conduct. Number two, we were in a period where very large premiums were being paid by insurgents in tender offers for the securities of target companies. As I recall, there were some situations where a stock might be selling at 39. And almost a 20-point premium was being offered for that. So therefore, if you were going to play the game of insider trading, number one, you had secrecy, and two, if you were lucky, you were going to hit a lot. Because the premium being paid, let's say, on $39 stock was 20 points. But now it's the third thing that really made it a worthwhile effort. And that was the options market. And that's what some of those early cases were about. You could go to the Pacific Stock Exchange. You could buy options by putting very little capital at risk. And if the tender offer occurred and the stock went from 39 to 59, with having very little capital at risk by just buying an option, your chance for a reward was enormous. Indeed, I forget whether it was Santa Fe or St. Joe, one of those early cases shut down some of the specialists at the Pacific Stock Exchange because the premium was so large and they were on the losing end of the trades. It shut them down or bankrupted them, and there was no way that the commission could move fast enough to recoup the money. So you put those three things together. They're easily understood. Every citizen's understood them. The newspapers understood them and wrote about them. The business magazines understood them and wrote about them. So there got to be, at a very early time, an endorsement of the insider trading program. You had people like Professor Henry Manny at George Mason, who's now emeritus, who said that insider trading should be legalized. And I debated him a number of times, and he has some very good points. But if his philosophy would be adopted, you'd have to revolutionize a lot of the things the commission did. It's not that he has bad ideas. It's that some of the consequences of his ideas would have to be taken into other areas. So what happens? I'm in the office. This is June when I take over as director. And I'd say by September 1, I'm receiving calls from the United States Ambassador in Switzerland. I'm being called by Swiss Bankers Association. I'm then being called by high government officials in Switzerland about what we were doing and the fact that we had frozen the bank accounts in the United States of customers of Swiss Bank who were doing business here. And that attracted a lot of attention. And now you had another dynamic that came into the picture that made this an attractive subject. Meaning that Congress wasn't going to restrain us. The White House wasn't going to restrain us from any executive or legislative area. No one was going to be saying we were wasting resources. And one of the themes got to be, I remember when I went and testified before Congressman Worth once, that I was soft on business. And he did shoot at me one time suggesting that insider trading was only against individuals and it was soft on business generally. But you know, that's politics. That's not truth. That's just politics. But anyway, so the cases began to develop. And then when the cases developed, the personalities of the people who were engaged in the misconduct became very interesting. Lawyers from Wall Street, noted individuals. So the newspaper had a new dynamic beyond the basic three reasons that I told you about. Now they had the foreign country that they could go and interview somebody like Jean Zwollen in Switzerland or Lionel, I forget Lionel's last name all of a sudden. But anyway, here I am. I'm nothing but a director of enforcement, and I'm being invited to Switzerland to negotiate with the government, to talk with the Swiss Bankers Association, to appear on television in Switzerland, to be taken by the U.S. ambassador to Switzerland to talk about these things, which eventually resulted in the memorandum of understanding with Switzerland and went on. But you must not focus on me in these situations. Look at the various levels of personalities that were involved. First of all, you had Ed Green as head of CorpFin and then as general counsel. You had Lee Spencer and John Huber. I'm talking about the other branches. You had Rich Ketchum. You had guys like Dan Gelser in general counsel's office. And then you looked at our own division. At the senior level, you had Ted Levine. And then soon after that, at the senior level, you had Gary Lynch. And then at the next level, you had Bill McLucas, who, like Lynch, became a director of enforcement. And then you had We brought in Alexia Morrison, an assistant United States attorney. And so the individuals that I was working with weren't individuals who I was a superior of. I might have had a title, but it was the homogenization of people who were willing to work together as a team that made this thing all work. Because no one is going to tell you that John Fetters brought great scholarship or anything like that. I was the director. I'm proud of what I did, but it was not John Fetters who did any of this. This is, you know, I never argued a single case. I may have taken a couple depositions while I was there, but, you know, I was director. I was taking people's ideas and trying to have an impact as a leader. I think it worked well.
Tell me a little bit about breathing those assets, because it is a very interesting situation where the Swiss are coming to you for a change instead of the other way around.
Right.
Did you make the decision to freeze those assets, or was that an FTC decision?
Well, you don't make the decision to freeze them. You make the decision to go to a federal district court judge and ask him to freeze them. Now, some of those assets had been frozen when I came on board. I do remember going to the Southern District of New York on one occasion and happening to be there, and we were trying to freeze some assets, and we were sent to by the court to the home of a U.S. federal district court judge, and he was already in his nightclothes. And we made a pitch there. But the process works this way, is that you identify that there's some unusual trading. And so you identify that after the announcement of a merger or a tender offer. Let's suppose that today X makes a tender offer for Y. Y is selling at 29. The tender offer is at 59. Well, that would send the people in the market surveillance unit back and surveil the market for several weeks. You would find maybe these option trades or some large unusual trades. You'd then engage in blue sheeting, which is simply a term for a sheet that was sent to brokers to find out who the persons were on the sides of the transaction. And you'd find out that it was maybe a Swiss bank who was acting on behalf of a customer. You'd contact them, and then they could not tell you the identity. And so then you would gather the facts, largely circumstantial evidence, but compelling circumstantial evidence, and you'd draft a complaint, and you'd go to the federal district court judge, and you would present this, really ex parte, and you would say, look, these are the facts that we've been able to garner. We know that the money is at this bank. We would like you to freeze that money in the United States until we have a time to go forward. And if the evidence is compelling, the judge, fortunately for the SEC, issued these freeze orders.
And you cited unknown persons.
Yes, that would be the way you would do it. You would cite unknown persons because you didn't know who they were, and then the complaint would explain that they were customers of the XYZ bank or the ABC bank and things of that nature. And so that, again, to the public, is very attractive. It's sexy news. And it would attract the media. It made television. You know, things that you don't expect about a routine kind of case. This is stuff you get on television. And all of a sudden, we're getting a lot of support for insider trading. And then you have the talent of guys like Ted Levine and Gary Lynch and McLucas and others to lead these cases. Guys who are extraordinarily careful, are not hip shooters, go to court with great professionalism, knew how to train young people so that when they were part of the team that it all went well. And fortunately, we didn't make any glaring mistakes in the early days of this, so the program created some momentum.
Were there cases in which you or somebody else said, you know, we don't have enough here. I don't want to jeopardize what we're doing over here by taking on this one?
Well, there's always cases that you filter down. I'll tell you, and I don't think this is any breach of confidence, the Paul Thayer case, he was Deputy Secretary of Defense. And when that investigation began, there were two young staff lawyers who had the case, and they did not believe that they had any information and came to Gary Lynch and myself and made a presentation of the case. And we excused them, and Gary and I talked, and we then went back to the two young attorneys and said, keep going. that, you know, we don't buy that there's nothing here. But there are other cases. You know, I think that maybe that was a good thing that I did in some cases. I would say the closed cases or that I don't think there's enough there. You have to be a manager. You know, keep in mind that there's no way that any agency in a civil context can police all of the insider trading. You know, somebody once asked me, what percentage of it do you think you got? Well, it's not like murder where if there's a dead body, you count it as one. Okay, it's unsolved. So you don't know. You do your best. You hope it's a deterrent to others. You want to create an atmosphere at a government agency that the public believes the cops on the beat. That's the first objective. And then you go forward.
Before I do want to get into the Paul Thayer case. But before we do that, I want to pick up the thread that you left with Switzerland.
Mm-hmm.
I assume you needed the help of the State Department to get over there and negotiate?
Well, we needed a lot of help. I was invited. I remember the phone calls saying that it would be appropriate to go. And nobody is going to suggest that John Fetters is a diplomat. So we, Ed Green and myself, he was then, I believe, general counsel, spent some time thinking about putting a team together. And we went with a gentleman from the State Department who was willing to take a back seat in the whole thing. And he went with us, but he never chose to be the dominant speaker. We went with a gentleman from the Department of Justice. I do remember his name, by the name of Roger Olson. And he chose not to be a centerpiece. So he was permitting the SEC to be the centerpiece of these negotiations. And then Ed and I decided that we had to take somebody with us. And it was an incredible stroke. There was a young man at the commission who I saw as a rising superstar by the name of Michael Mann. And we took him to Switzerland with us. And his career was meteoric after that. He then became, when the Division of Enforcement had an international section for a while, and other divisions did, and they created a division for international matters. And Michael Mann was put as director of that division and is today one of the preeminent lawyers in that area. So he went with us. So, and then we were met by the U.S. ambassador over there, Ambassador Whittlesey, and it began to be a series of breakfast meetings, meetings with government, meeting with the Bankers Association. I gave any number of speeches when I was over there. Now, that's something that I enjoy doing. So that being in that part of the spotlight was not hard for us. And they liked what we said. I think if Ed Green were here and he was trying to put a patina on how we acted, I think we were pretty conservative. I think we minded our manners. You'll see up on the mantle there a cartoon of a United States animal eating a Swiss animal. The United States animal has a flag around its nose and the Swiss animal. And that appeared in the New Zurich Zeitung. And I think the caption on it is, we are the most aggressive law enforcement agency. And after I gave this speech over there, that appeared in the New Zurich Zeitung the next day. And so that was the media's turn of it. And then we returned to the United States, and we got a lot of calls to come back. And so we made a second trip, and then we began to develop what was called the Memorandum of Understanding, or short MOU, and that was signed in a big ceremony. And that was signed by Chairman Shadd and Jean Zwollen on behalf of the Swiss and a few other people. Ambassador Whittlesey came home for the ceremony.
Was it essentially they want their assets unfrozen, you want the names of the people who own the bank? And was it essentially figuring out a good way to do that?
It was a means to do that. It wasn't simply, we're the United States, we want the names if we're going to unfreeze the assets. There was a system, a very thoughtful system about how we would go to them. We would identify certain information. There were checks and balances in the process. And And I think some of the genius of Mike Mann began to get in there as a very young lawyer at an early time. Ed was an extreme. Ed Green is clearly one of the most skilled lawyers I've ever met, and a wonderful creative guy. So his ideas, and they began to farm together. The people from the Justice Department, the State Department, and the Swiss had their own ideas. And the only thing that I can say in retrospect is that we operated slowly and we never pushed, even though that's probably part of my personality to do that, is that we were restrained. We went over there and showed great respect, talked about the system, talked about why liquidity in our markets and integrity in our markets was important to them. That, you know, they invested an enormous amount of capital in our market. They would want it to be fair. They would want it to be liquid. They wanted it to be swift. And that if we weren't able to police our own markets by impediments in these kinds of jurisdictions of secrecy, we would the markets would not have this liquidity, speed, integrity. And I don't think they bought it. They believed it. It was part of the, you know, buying it would be a pejorative term. What I'm saying, it was part of their grain. That, you know, yeah, it made sense. And so I would take a little credit for the fact that we were gentlemen. The ideas, they came from a lot of different people. And I'm not a diplomat. I don't have that skill. I'm not a charming guy.
Switzerland, of course, because the Santa Fe case was that was done through Switzerland.
Santa Fe and St. Joe Mineral both, yeah.
As well, did this transfer over to other companies? I mean, the Bahamian, you know, probably.
Slowly, and I would say that my successors developed that. Mike Mann. And under his directorship and the chairmanship of other chairmen other than Shedd, entered into a lot more MOUs. I'm not sure during my directorship there were any more MOUs. I know that there was the beginnings because I remember going to three or four other countries after that, and it wasn't the way I wanted to spend my time. If you go to another country, it's a 4 or 5 day, and that isn't where I belonged. But that's what I was asked to do. I remember particularly going to England. I remember going to France. I remember going to Germany. And I have a sense there was another country, but I could be wrong.
Well, back in the States, one thing we haven't talked about that we should probably get to is the context of all of this insider trading.
Well, the context is easy. It never became the dominant program. If you look at the number of cases that we brought and compare that to the overall program, the main thrust of the program remained disclosure kinds of issues, accounting fraud, broker-dealer misconduct, all of that kind of stuff. And that was good for us because we had something to ring the bell with. And insider trading to attract attention, but we had all these other programs that were going quite well, never were pushed aside, all the young lawyers, as I recall, wanted to have one insider trading case among the cases that they were investigating, and I don't know if that was possible or not. I don't have that good a memory, but insider trading was the bell. It rang the bell, but the other things kept going. And we did our share of accounting cases. We didn't have things that were of these enormous frauds like Enron or WorldCom or Tyco, things like that. But we had our cases. And Glenn Perry came in from the outside. He came from Pete Marwick. And I guess that was something unusual that I did. I created a position in the Division of Enforcement of a chief accountant in the division. And Glenn Perry came and did it. And then Bob Sack came in after Glenn went back to Pete, and Sack was very, very good as well. They were two guys who really had the ability to homogenize themselves with the staff, and they were fun to work with, and they had a lot of ideas, and they were good teachers because you're dealing with so many young lawyers. They want to learn. You know, they're looking for the day they get enough chevrons on their sleeve that maybe they might leave. And so And Perry and Sack were extraordinary at that.
The legal background to all of this. You had the Chiarella decision in 80 or so?
No, that was after that because I came in 81. Chiarella came after I was there.
So it was in 81.
Yeah, Dirks really started. Dirks was a decision and Chiarella, and then there were Carpenter. There were a number of them. The court supported what we were doing. While Dirks was adverse to the commission and supported Ray Dirks, and that case was argued by David Bonderman at Arnold and Porter, one of my former partners, Dirks didn't hurt the commission.
No,
it. See, I always feel that if you get a case and it gives you direction on how to plead your cases in the future and things like that, that you might lose one case, but you gain a lot.
Well, we were talking about the Dirks case, and I guess you were alluding to the fact that there were things in the decision that gave you some sense of how to proceed in the future.
Sure. All these cases that came along, whether Dirks or Chiarella or Carpenter, they give you some sense of moving forward. It wasn't just the Supreme Court. The Second Circuit had decisions in some of those cases, and they sharpened your pleadings. You had more confidence when you would plead the next time that, look at this, this is being pled in accordance with Dirks or Chiarella. Make sure, certainly from an institutional point of view, no government agency likes to lose a case. Everybody, isn't that part of human nature? You like to win all the time, but it's not the way it works. And so you've got to take the good things that come out of these cases, and the good things is that you can have more confidence as you go forward. And I think that happened during that period of time.
So did that change the way you approached some of the...
I don't think it changed the way you approached it much. You knew what you had to have, and you knew how it had to be pled. And, I can't say... I recall a couple cases after some decisions, a decision being made very quickly to close down a case or two. I do remember a couple instances of that. But the impact on the program of closing a couple cases is de minimis. The private bar certainly likes the fact that the SEC loses because it gives them something to champion, gives them new arguments maybe, narrows things and all that, but that's part of the adversarial process. But I don't ever recall any case coming down during my tenure or really knowing the commission as I do, where you have to go into great depression over a loss. You learn from it, and there's good scholarship in all of those things.
John Shadd, of course, very publicly put a lot of his stock in the insider trading.
He sure did. Hobnail boots.
Yeah. Did he ever come to you and say, I spent my neck out there. How are you doing on that insider trading stuff?
No, he never said it that way, but he would meet with all the division directors fairly frequently. And so I met with John Shadd often enough that I don't think he ever asked the question. I was always telling him what we were doing. The people, again, who worked for me were very good in giving me periodic reports. We had a Monday morning staff meeting, sort of a where are we, senior staff, both associate directors and assistant directors, so that I could tell Shad what we were doing and where we were. I don't think John ever suggested that we do one thing as opposed to another. He liked ideas. He liked different things. John Shadd was a man who, by our division, was kept very well advised where we were, and I know that the other division directors did too. The one thing when you're in an institution like that, and particularly with a guy like John Shadd, no surprises. That would be the worst thing you could do is to create a surprise.
Because he's got people ringing his bell, John Daigle, William Proxmire, folks like that, I guess.
Well, they're certainly watching him. I don't think they ever attack John as a program-oriented chairman in saying that his program was no good. John took some personal shots over his wealth and whether it was sufficiently entrusted, if that be the proper words. John Shedd, it was a smart cookie. And when we would go for congressional hearings, there might be some questions that were probative, and it might be put in the tone that it was adversarial. But he was smart enough, and I think all the division directors were smart enough to know, well, this is part of the deal. If you go up there to the Hill and you're testifying, there are senators or congressmen to the left, and there are some to the right, and some of them are of your political party, and some are not, and you've got to accept that. Yes, we could say that it's a beautiful, cool day after all the heat we've had in Washington, and somebody would say it's not cool enough. So I don't think John ever got upset about that. He prepared himself well when he went up there for congressional hearings.
Did you participate in those?
I participated in some. Somebody recently was telling me that I testified 20 times before Congress while I was at the SEC. And certainly when there was John and division directors, I remember going up and testifying before both Congress and the Senate on the Insider Trading Sanctions Act, which was new at that time. And I sat with John and other, I think Ed Green was at the table then, testified about Southland, testified about our enforcement program. If I was up there 20 times, so be it. But
Well, you touched on something that's next on my list, which is the Insider Trading Sanctions Act.
Right.
How much of that was the result of initiative by the SEC?
I'd say a very large part of it. I'd give a lot of credit to Ed Green and the people in the general counsel's office. I'd give a lot of credit to the people who worked for me. I certainly read and was a participant in a lot of discussions as to whether there ought to be a definition of insider trading, and I think at one time internally I suggested that I thought it was a pretty good idea. Now, I've always been one who believed that the tendency of the law should narrow the uncertainty, and that maybe by a definition you'd make it more certain. But the overwhelming majority, which was that, no, keep it broad. 10b-5 itself is broad. It's flexible. It permits you to attack new kinds of fraud or new things that are out there. And I think that's part of the commission mentality that has nothing to do with me or the period I was there. I think it goes all the way back to the guys who began in 34. They were this broad scope protect the institution and its ability, as opposed to maybe sometimes not thinking about it as much about those people who are operating under the law. But when I went there, I remember even talking to Shedd when we were in the park. He asked me about some of my philosophies, and he ticked off a number of ideas. And I remember saying to him, I thought the tendency of the law should always narrow the field of uncertainty. And I think that's something I recall saying at the meetings when we were talking about a definition. But, yeah, I think the SEC itself was largely responsible for that. If we hadn't pushed, I don't mean me, but if John Shedd and Ed Green and the commissioners hadn't pushed for the Insider Trading Sanctions Act, I don't think it would have occurred.
How much of the provisions came from consultation with folks at the SEC? How much came from straight from the Hill?
That I don't know. I couldn't give you a percentage or even an estimate of it. Just in hindsight, I would think that an awful lot of it came from Ed Green and his folks in general counsel, and I'm sure there was consultation with the Hill, and I'm sure some of the committee reports were written by staff people at the SEC.
Did it seem to make a big difference?
No.
The ones that went in?
It created a new penalty. It gave lawyers something to negotiate about. But I don't think that you could say that once the act was passed that insider trading went away or became de minimis. But, of course, nobody has any statistics and nobody has any ability to create statistics. It's all, what do you think? And one thing that Shedd provided me an opportunity to do is that when I would be going to New York for one or more reasons, he would always set up a series of meetings. that I could meet people on the street to talk about what was going on and what are we missing and things like that. He brought Warren Buffett to the commission at one time, and I remember spending a good couple hours with him in my office and asking him about what did he think the commission was missing. And did it make a difference? I don't know. Maybe. It certainly gave the legal community something new to talk about, something new to negotiate. And were we going to hit people with 3x penalties? And the trade became the 1x1. That if your ill-gained profits that you had to disgorge were $100,000, then you got another $100,000 under the Penalty Act. And there's a few that are greater than that, but it became very quickly a 1x1 or a 1+1, however you would say it.
I've heard it said that the penalties, people can ignore those. It's throwing people in jail that makes them less.
Well, the criminal aspect of it, of the enforcement of the federal securities laws, has certainly had a big impact since 1980. It's changed. I remember going up, and I think Gary Lynch went with me, and we met with Rudy Giuliani in the Southern District. We met with the U.S. attorney in, I think I was alone then, for the guy in Boston. He's a famous politician, became maybe governor of Boston, or governor of Massachusetts. I forget his name right now. He was running for something in New York where he's migrated to. I remember going to the U.S. attorney's office in Chicago and San Francisco and a few other places and trying to interest them in our program that they would bring it. And sure, if I have a client today who has done wrong things and the government's investigating him, he might say, look, I understand that I might have to take an injunction and pay a fine. But he said, I'm here because I don't want my liberties to be taken from me. And my main charge to you is, if we got to take an injunction, if I got to pay a fine where I lose a lot of money, I can live with that. But I can't live with going to jail. And that would disrupt my family life, and it would be an embarrassment too great to take. So an awful lot of times you face a client even today, and that's the litany you hear.
Yeah. You're talking about going around to Boston, Chicago, New York. Are you talking about the hypothetical here? We may want to work together on prosecuting insider trading if it should happen, or were you talking about specific cases?
Both. And I don't think it was just insider trading. We were trying to drum up business in other areas as well. Certainly going to meet Rudy Giuliani and some of his colleagues, I think there were some particular cases that were already in the pipeline that we were specifically talking about. When I went to Boston, to the U.S. attorney there, I think the Boston regional director went with me, and in Chicago, the regional director there. So the visit was diplomatic. It was trying to interest them in a program. I've always used, and I say this irreverently, that most U.S. attorneys have political ambitions, and if they can bring some popular cases in the insider trading or other securities area, it might enhance their eventual run for governor. So, and I think I was blunt enough to say that to some of them. We would laugh about it, but I knew that there was more truth in it than humor.
Well, you had bookends of government cases, too, and you referred to the Thayer case.
Yes.
Before that was Tom Reed. Do you remember that?
Right, I remember Reed well.
Were there any significant implications to those cases other than the fact that here's some guys who were well known?
No one at any time ever tried to restrain us. No one in the administration knew the cases were in the pipeline, I think, until the very end. I remember the Thayer case much more clearly because when that case was approved at the commission table, when they approved the case, either Chairman Chad or somebody else said, don't you think it would be advisable to advise the White House? And the commissioners unanimously said yes. When the meeting was over, I called Fred Fielding, who was counsel to President Reagan, and I wasn't about to go over there myself. And Gary Lynch and I went, and we reported to him what was going to happen within the next few days. And I went back to our offices, and within an hour, I got a call from Mr. Fielding saying he would like me to brief Secretary Caspar Weinberger at the Defense Department, and boom, I grabbed Gary Lynch and we went over there and briefed him. But
so why didn't you want to go over by yourself?
You know, I'm visible by my height. I am a conservative Republican, and you don't want anyone to suggest that something might have happened at a meeting and to have to articulate it to yourself. And I don't know Gary Lynch's politics today. I didn't know him then, but he was, a most trusted advisor and a man whom I had great faith in and would help make the presentation. And I remember that the only question asked at both meetings at the White House and at the Department of Defense was, you should do what you believe is right, and are you sure? You know? And in both cases, we were. We were confident that we were. And it was good experiences. It's the kind of thing that people's interested in. You went to the White House, you went to the State Department, but, you know, they weren't significant in the overall thing. Nobody was going to suggest to us that we not do this. That never even crossed my mind. It was a matter of doing the right thing so that an administration is not embarrassed and can put their ducks in a row to understand that this is coming.
And you weren't reaching for any new legal theories to prosecute?
No.
One where perhaps you were would have been the Foster Wyman's case, which mm-hmm. came toward the end of your time
right.
in enforcement. Now, I understand you were recused from that case because of the Arnold and Portland.
Yeah, eventually, I think there was a gentleman, I think his name was Clark, that was involved in that case, and Arnold and Porter, retained Arnold and Porter at some time. The case was well along as far as an investigation, and then I had to step aside from the case.
Right. So you put Gary Lynch in there?
Well, I wouldn't put Gary Lynch in there. Gary Lynch was in there. I mean, you know, I didn't have to put. That's one of the things you got to understand about this is that while I was director and I'd like to give myself a minuscule credit for leadership, these were extraordinarily talented people. I mean, look at what Gary did as director. Ted Levine, should have or could have, however you want to say it, been director when I was appointed. You know, a man who has preeminent knowledge of the federal securities laws, Gary, then reaching down, as I said before, McLucas. These were extraordinary people I was working with. There wasn't anybody I had to go over there and train and teach the federal securities laws. So I didn't put Gary Lynch in charge. He was in charge, and he did the right thing and moved the case along, yeah.
But he took a lot of heat for this idea that the SEC was going to bring action against the journalists.
Yeah, I was still a part of the case when the three chief editors of the Wall Street Journal came down, and when we told them what we believed had occurred, et cetera, like that. But, you know, I don't think the publicity was adverse or sustained adverse. There were people who, you know, protect an estate, the Fourth Estate, and that they had an interest in doing that. But it's like cases that are popular today that, without mentioning names, where, you know, if somebody's done something wrong, you can't hide behind the fact that you're a congressman or a reporter or whatever. Wrongdoing is wrongdoing. And I think when people analyze the case and what we concluded and what eventually Gary and the staff and the commission concluded, I never considered it to be negative. Might have been, you know, every day you get a bad story about something, but you can't live your life, nor can a governmental agency or a prosecutor particularly live their life by worrying about negativity. You want to do it right. You want to consider yourself to be operating within the scope of the law. I certainly wouldn't want to be, you know, out on the outer edges of the law. Because I don't think that's necessary to run an effective law enforcement program.
Well, I'd like to start to wrap up with getting to some larger questions, or maybe one larger question,
okay.
Which is, you know, during these 5 years, four or five years, you're in enforcement. Did you see things change significantly in the way that the job was done, the way the division functioned?
People tell me things, and I'd like to believe that some of it is true. But anytime you embark upon a conversation like that, some people could infer that I'd be critical of my predecessor or something like that. I'm very different than Stanley Sporkin in personality, in appearance, in attitude, in all kinds of things. So, sure, I brought what John Fetters could bring. I think, you know, some people have said to me that there was a heightened degree of professionalism, much more attention to detail. Some people were afraid of me when I first went there. And I guess if it was a healthy respect, I'm happy. If it was a fear, I'm sad. Sure, it changed. It should be changed because of the personalities. Ted Levine left in the middle of there, and that was an enormous loss. And then Gary moved up, and Bill McLucas and other people moved up, and their personalities changed it is too, because the demanding nature of some of the people who replaced other people who were there, it became a very demanding place to work.
What about priorities?
I shifted priorities because I went there with the intention of doing that, because that was part of the conversation with John Shadd. I have written articles about the whole questionable payment era, and my view on that is pretty well noted.
The question of what?
The questionable payment era.
Oh, right. Sure.
Yes. I have certain views with regard to the anti-bribery provisions of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and I made a statement to an assistant director once that became big newspaper publicity about what I said about a case that they were investigating. There were areas that I didn't think that we needed to be in or to have the kind of prominence that historically had been in. But you would, you know, from myself, I would only be critical of myself if the program was less active, it didn't bring cases in core areas, and didn't make an impact in what we were doing. So there are one or two cases that I'm not free to mention that I look back upon, two in particular, that I have great regrets about how they were handled. And I know that mistakes were made, and I'm prepared to take the responsibility for that. But that's only really two cases out of, you know, 4.5 years of work. If I didn't affect a change, then something's wrong, because then I didn't exercise my personality or the human qualities that I brought to the place. And people either found me attractive, where they would want to cooperate and be a part of the team, or they found me unattractive and they would rebel against those notions. And my own sense is that there was little, if any, rebellion during my tenure there. I think it was a team. A lot of the good sense that I have that it was a team occurred after I left, because I left under such hard circumstances for myself. And the extraordinary communication that I received from so many people, not just at the home office, but at the regional office level, I think it was a good period, and I feel good. And I don't want to ever take the credit for it. I've been really, really lucky with these people that I worked with. I would say, you know, I've been at great law firms, and I've worked with some extraordinary lawyers at every place I've worked. And I like to think that my tenure at the Commission in the Division of Enforcement, we had an extraordinary law firm. And that, if somebody would confirm that, that would be enough for me. I don't need to hear anything more. But I know in my heart that we were an extraordinary good law firm.
Well, that sounds like a great place to wrap it up.
Good.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.